to film festival if you're watching, or otherwise, just enjoy movies. Good night.
Carve on 2SCR.
And have a conversation offline.
Darn, I'd be bothered to carve, you can't.
Sydney's arts and culture show.
Flat Earth Society had this big conspiracy theory about
arts.
These kind of false idols.
On 2SCR 107.3.
Good morning and welcome to Carve, your weekly exploration into Sydney's arts and culture, keeping you connected and creative this lockdown. My name is Lockie Pringle and I'm your host this morning. Before we start the show, I would like to acknowledge the Gadigal people, who are the traditional custodians of this land from where we are broadcasting. I would also like to pay respect to the elders past, present and emerging of the Eora Nation. Always was, always will be Aboriginal land. We've got a bit of a film-themed show today, with Ellen speaking to Steve Bisley about The Stranger, a film showing at this year's Sydney Film Festival. And I'll be joined by Carl Davis, who directed Dry Winter, which is part of the program at the Melbourne International Film Festival this year. But first up, Sally will be joined by Joel Spring, the guest editor of Runway Journal's 44th issue, themed around time. That's all coming up after this. You're listening to 2SER.
Hi, this is Andre from The Space in Between. At 2SCR, we're doing our best to keep you company during lockdown. So stay safe, look after yourselves and each other. You can tune in to The Space in Between at 107.3 on Tuesday nights at 10 p.m. or at any time at 2SCR.com.
You're listening to Carve Arts and Culture on 2SER, and today we're chatting about digital art and writing. Runway Journal is a digital platform that cultivates and preserves experimental art and writing practices. For 19 years, Runway has been commissioning and publishing artworks and writing that responds to thematic callouts, at first in print and now wholly online. Each year they publish two issues, and today Sally is talking to Joel Spring, guest editor of their upcoming issue, which is themed around time. Joel Spring is a Wiradjuri man raised between Redfern and Alice Springs, who works across research, activism, architecture, installation and speculative projects. At present, his work focuses on the contested narratives of Sydney's and Australia's urban culture and Indigenous history in the face of ongoing colonisation.
Joel, great to have you here. Welcome to Carve.
Thanks for having me, Sally.
You're guest editing Runway Journal's 44th edition, where you're calling for writing and artwork themed around the concept of time. And in the call out, you write, time is money, time is a political tool, time is a measurement, time is a feeling, time is different if you're a single mum on the bus. How do you see time being linked with money and politics?
Wow. Well, I think, it's sort of simplistic or a little bit obvious, you know, to think about analogies of, you know, time as money or time is money. Value is kind of, if you want to talk about it in like a Marxist perspective, right? Like value is applied to an object through labor, which is, you know, someone's time. As well as, you know, I think you talk to a lot of people in general, and depending on their particular positionality, I think we could all use a bit more time. And I think in the current kind of capitalist situation that we find ourselves in, our time is money in lots of ways, whether that be your labor or the luxuries that you afford yourself. You know, usually you're forking over money to enjoy something for a period of time. I mean, that's all a bit simple. I think the call out for me in a big way was thinking about what other perspectives people had on it and sort of finding the sort of mess in our kind of own individual or cultural relationships to time, because it's obviously ubiquitous in the sense that it's how we run the economy, it's how we run things efficiently, it's how we all keep across many forms of movement in our life. But it's also incredibly subjective, I think, in the ways that we move through the world and experience it. And I guess the list for the runway journal that I wrote for things to consider have just sort of been the start of kind of digging at the kind of multiple interpretations or reflections on what time can mean to people.
And one of the memes that you use in the call out is one that's been circulating recently around the internet, which says, like, I don't know what time is anymore. All I know is pre-11 a.m. press conference with Gladys and post-11 a.m. press conference with Gladys. And I was reflecting on that and thinking about how at this time, the internet has been actually quite a bit of a source of joy for me. And one of the best things that you can find on the internet is humor. So I was wondering how you connect with humor in your work, and if that's something that you're interested in exploring with the issue.
Yeah, absolutely. I think something that's really interesting, especially about that meme, or just kind of memes in general, at times, is one, to talk about time, how efficient they are, right? Like, it's kind of so interesting for us to engage in these, like, incredibly, I don't know, loaded imagery that sort of can create very interesting and sort of funny circumstances very quickly. I think memes in a sort of more abstract or conceptual way are really, really amazing. I think a really good meme is a work of art. And that comes down to, I think, the ways that it can resonate in, what am I trying to say? I think they're efficient because they can kind of link to experiences and ideas quite quickly. There's sort of a new set of symbols that kind of comes out of us being so tied to these devices that kind of expand across language and meaning. And sort of the ways that they, I mean, I could talk about memes for a really long time, but I think language and humor is really important. I think especially when talking about something so serious, or at least in the past, a lot of the work that I have done and kind of continue to do is quite heavy and quite serious. So it's always important to find opportunities for levity or humor, or just like how surreal and absurd the world is, especially right now. And I think in another way that has a reflection in talking about time for me, because we all agree on what time it is, and that is an amazing and very interesting thing, because like time doesn't really exist. It's a construction that we kind of all play along with. And I mean, you can think about it in different ways, but I think that that's a really interesting opportunity to sort of unpack the absurdity of like everyday life and kind of give it new meaning and think about the different ways that we're experiencing things. Because I think we have to, I don't know, for me, this is another kind of tangent. I feel like time is trying to like flatten everything out a bit for everybody, which is really great if you're like trying to run an efficient capitalist economy and trying to do all these things. But I think it also, questioning it offers opportunities to hold many possibilities all at once. And I think that that's really interesting, and for me the point of making work. So I think within the call out I'm the most interested in the sort of funny, personal, subjective interpretations of what time is and how humorous that is for us all.
Well, the you also talk about the Hyde Park Barracks clock tower being on unceded Gadigal lands, and you talk about how this is the first public timekeeping device to exist on the Australian, well, what we call Australia, on the continent. And it's been used to structure the labour and the movements of convicts or the militia. And I wanted to talk to you about how there's been such a lot of debate recently internationally about public statues as they are oppressive symbols of colonisation. I was interested because I'd never really heard about someone referring to a clock tower as part of one of those oppressive symbols of colonizations. And I thought that was really interesting.
Mm.
So is that something that you think about when you look at that clock tower?
So, yeah, I mean, the Hyde Park Barracks is a pretty interesting place. It's become a bit of a node for me in a lot of the research that I've been doing recently. So I work at UTS in the design faculty. I graduated from architecture master's, and now I'm sort of working as a researcher and a tutor, potentially going to do a PhD soon. And so I've been doing some research centered around the Hyde Park Barracks for a few months now, and I've been spending quite a bit of time there. So it's been interesting thinking through a singular object and the way that it sort of moves through, has moved through time, that building, the materials that it's made out of, I think are all kind of really interesting. I think a clock is definitely establishing a different relationship, right? And a different order. I mean, it is about order and ordering the labor of convicts and other people on this place. We don't question the sort of practical stuff that makes sense about the situations that we're in at the moment. And there's like histories of colonization, extractivist practices, all of the kind of problematic relationships we have between each other and the earth right now, are all structured by really boring, banal, and like kind of invisible factors in so many ways. And I mean, that's the project of colonialism and colonization, is to sort of reach this 100. I kind of think about it sometimes as like a loading bar on a download or something, where it's like approaching 100% colonization or colonialism, which like a city is operating like, is to completely disconnect it from context and place and belonging and understanding of what was here before. And that's impossible, at least I believe that, and as long as Aboriginal people, Torres Strait Islander people, you know, First Nations across the globe exist, that is going to be impossible. But I think it's sort of an interesting thing to realize is the sort of the point, as much as, I mean, yeah, it's kind of the point of these structures is to erase, shift the relationships, change these conversations, and support us in our lifestyles that were introduced here, because that's how settler colonialism works, right? It settles in a place, and that that dynamic, the things that allow us to exist. I think it's not to say that it's objectively or flat out wrong. There's quite a lot of things that we can't change about the past, but I think it's for me at least, an interesting thing for to research and to problematize and to think about is that the realities that we live in at the moment come at the cost of others. And I think that that can be talked about through time, because I think, you know, we operate in a system or an economy or a lifestyle that prioritizes economic development and growth. Infinite growth, but we don't live in an infinite planet, and we don't exist. We exist within limits. So, how do we think about or understand those limits? And for me, in a lot of ways, not just in relationship to the sort of, I guess, phenomenon of like a clock being erected in a new place where there wasn't a clock before. Of course, there was timekeeping and cultures around that existed here since the first sunrise. But this new imposition of a relationship to the stars and the sun and the sky and how to order labor, took away from something else and continues to take away from something else. And that's, I think, what we have to understand about the position that we're all in at the moment is, the things that we like and the things that we enjoy and the things that we do often are coming at the cost of other things.
Yeah. And I suppose artists can do with that symbol what they will. So what are you looking for in entries into the issue? I know that Runway is a digital publication, so the artists have to be really practiced in digital art and writing, or do they have to be established writers? Who can apply?
I would love to see as many people as possible. Obviously, I have a bias towards engaging with any really trying to prioritize First Nations, Indigenous, especially Black and Brown women, female identifying femmes otherwise to the front. But for the most part, I would like to see. I mean, it's a privilege to be in a position to even say, like, I would like to see this. I think what's exciting and what I've taken from my own experience, kind of reading and participating with Runway and now being asked to be the guest editor for an issue is their kind of mission statement is about sort of platforming and developing practices as well. So there's a real, I think, interest in looking at emerging artists who are looking to try and develop either, multimedia projects that could be platformed on the website or their own writing practices. If you do enter, I understand, and your proposal gets through, I understand that myself and some of the other Runway team will be kind of on board in a kind of position to facilitate as mentors in the kind of editing process.
Fantastic. Well, Joel, that's probably all we have time for.
Easy. Well, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for coming on Carve.
That was Sally chatting to Joel Spring, who is guest editing Runway Journal's 44th issue around the theme of time. Applications are now open and close at midnight on Sunday, the 29th of August. To read more about the call-out and submit your application, head to runway.org.au. Up next, Ellen will be speaking to Aussie legend Steve Bisley about The Stranger, a short film that is showing as part of Sydney Film Festival. Don't go anywhere, but right now it's time to hear a new single release by friend of the show and Carve Live performer Anso. So Damn Loud was released yesterday, and here it is now. You're listening to 2SER. Put up, don't give a fuck about all your problems. Get under my imagination, and they got a bad chunk. So try and get in my way because you're becoming an eyesore. Don't feel the same, can't go back, can't remember anymore. All your questions, oh my god, who is this so damn for? Keep joining, and I'll get your magic, kid. My own heart, I'm not happy, I'm not a psycho, yeah. So many questions from your mouth, so many questions, so
three, four. make it better.
SER is a volunteer-powered community radio station with studios at Broadway and Macquarie Park. For over 40 years, we've been training media students, spinning good tunes and sharing local stories. If you'd like to get involved behind the scenes and help keep us on air, register your interest at 2ser.com/volunteer.
You're listening to Carve on 2SER and you just heard So Damn Loud by Anso. This week, Ellen spoke to Aussie icon Steve Bisley about The Stranger, a short feature film directed by Jenny Hicks. When a stranger arrives at an isolated farmhouse late at night, the farmer's wife is convinced he's trouble. In the light of day, she is forced to confront her prejudices. The Stranger is showing as part of Sydney Film Festival this November and is a finalist for the Dendy Awards. Here is Ellen and Steve.
Steve Bisley, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Oh, thanks, Ellen. It's a pleasure.
So during these crazy COVID times, you've played the role of John in Jenny Hicks's short film, The Stranger. Yeah. So in a nutshell, what is this film all about?
Well, it's always difficult when a film hasn't been released. It's sort of, I don't want to give it away, but it's... So I was attracted to Jenny's script, and it was her graduation film from AFTERS. So, and it was it's a three-hander, so it's myself and Fiona Press, who plays my wife, and Harry Greenwood, who plays the stranger. And so it was early COVID times, we were all masked until we had to perform. We had to be 1.5 metres apart even when we were in performance. Which was all a bit sort of crazy because we had to rejig a lot of stuff to accommodate that. That was the early days of the sort of COVID. But we shot it at this beautiful historic house out of Denman, which is up in Upper Hunter. So basically, the story, it's a psychological a thriller. Mm. And it happens one night when myself and my wife Fiona are asleep and a young man turns up at the farm. Mm. And he wants something to eat. So I leave Margaret, my wife, and I go down and I make him some food.
Mm.
And he has a little episode. So without giving too much away, so it's the course of events over that night, and it really addresses empathy and sort of understanding. So we are changed by his visit.
Yeah, that's right. And I understand that you grew up on a farm in New South Wales, just like the character you were playing. What was it like? What was it like to revisit your roots?
I think the farm's always been in me. It was, we had a small farm. It was only 15 acres. My parents sort of market gardened it early on in the piece, and then they both became teachers, but we kept the farm. We didn't have electricity till I was 14, so it was all combustion stoves and kerosene lamps and stuff. So, to go back and to have an experience like that in the film, although it's it was a beautiful house, it's very grand house.
Mm.
In fact, when the first day we went up to location, I remember walking up to the house thinking, God, I might have to rethink my character altogether. This is all a bit grand. but, but So it was okay. It was all right.
That's so funny.
Jenny is just a fantastic director and a great writer. And I think she's going to have a big future, this girl.
I think so too. Now, back to the story without obviously giving away too much. The film does focus on the theme of mental health. And as you said before, empathy. Why do you think stories like these are so important?
Yeah, I think what they do, if handled well, they hopefully debunk that sort of stigma that exists around mental health.
Yeah.
And that's in our film as well. The notion that someone who's a little different or who acts differently should be viewed with suspicion and fear, you know.
Mm, yeah.
I can remember I worked, before I became an actor, I worked at a sheltered workshop for disabled people, yeah, way back when I was in my late teens. And I remember people with Down syndrome, I remember how they were viewed publicly. I'd be out in the public with, you know, some of the people from the workshop who were Down syndrome affected, and you could see people shrink away from them, you know, as if the affliction was somehow wrought with potential danger, and you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So I think I think cinema's got a role in this too. That we get to educate people, hopefully, and remove the stigma around it.
Definitely, and to what you're saying, celebrate differences and.
Yeah, that's right. And I think the journey that John and Margaret, the farmer and his wife, made significant over the course of that night into the next morning, having had exposure to this young man. So, you know, and Jenny is very clever as a writer too. Of, you know, it's only 20 minutes in length, but to she packs so much into it. The suspense is fantastic. It's really gripping because just the house itself, you know, those old houses, you know, it's two stories and you've got all that sort of dark wood, and it really lends itself to the story.
Yeah, it's so, like, the set design is so beautiful, and of course the lighting, which you mentioned, the transition from morning to night, and how Jenny has really explored those, you know, those themes in cinema.
Yeah, and that sort of, you know, underscores people's fears, you know, at night when she's sort of prowling the house when she can't sleep. And then the next morning it's bright and clear and a new day, you know, and so with that comes some sort of change.
Yeah, the viewer really goes on the journey with Margaret and John, which is really incredible. And I've watched it a couple of times now, and watching it the second and the third time, your perceptions really change, and I find that to be super interesting.
Yes, I agree. And it's nuanced beautifully. There was, we had backstories, like the farm. There's, I think at the opening of the film, Margaret, the wife, is going through bills that are mounting up, and I think like a lot of people on the land, there's all sorts of pressures, financial pressures on them. And there was this notion that John could lose that farm, which had been, you know, in his family for generations. And although it's not heavily underscored, that was there as a backstory. So just to have that knowledge that, you know, you don't want to be the guy in the lineage of your family that loses the, you know, everything the family sort of stood for.
Yeah. And there's all the undertones of the drought happening.
The drought happening, yeah. And it was interesting to shoot it in the, not in the middle, in a pandemic. It was like a jolly. And that in itself is another pressure, but hey, that doesn't play in the film, of course, but my God, who knew?
I mean, I'm just imagining like a boom person, like how them standing like, you know, a long distance away. Yeah.
Oh, no, it was super surreal because you go into makeup and obviously we had to de-mask in makeup. Then the makeup girls were all masked up and we had, because it was produced through AFTERS, we had a lot of students on the film as well. So not only were they facing the pressures of, you know, of shooting a film, but they had the added thing about, you know, being masked and being 1.5 metres. And we had someone on the set at all times who was there just to make sure all the COVID stuff was being addressed. I remember Margaret and I were in bed and we still had to be 1.5 metres apart.
Oh, my gosh.
Now, that's pretty – I think that's wider than a king-size bed. So, yeah, I know. It was very odd.
Well, this means I have to watch it for a fourth time and look out for all the social distancing.
Yeah, well, have a look. But we did, you know, it was just another thing to address. And I think that's the nature of a film too. You're constantly, you know, rejigging and finding ways to do whatever. So that was, we're just sort of used to that anyway. So, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm in Sydney. A lot of our audience is in Sydney at the moment. And, of course, we're in our second lockdown. I was scrolling through your Instagram, which is at Steve_the_gift_Bisley, by the way.
I always have to explain that.
So funny.
You want me to explain it quickly?
Let's do it. Yeah, please.
Okay, so the reason I'm Steve_the_gift because up till last December I was living in Sydney and I came over to Perth to be with my partner because I hadn't seen him for the best part of a year because of the hard border lockdown. Anyway, prior to coming over, I was in my local supermarket. This woman came up to me and said, "Can I just say you're so busy?" And I said, "Yeah." And she said, can I just say you're a gift?" Oh, no. And I said, "Oh, thanks very much. That's lovely. Thank you." And so I just thought, you know, I'm the gift.
That's so funny.
Yeah, I guess too. But I think it pisses a lot of people off. I think what's busily thinking, you know, I don't know.
So, yeah, back to the question. I'm glad we covered that. That's so good. But I was scrolling and I noticed a bunch of a horse walks in a bar jokes from March last year. I was wondering, do you have any more horse jokes for those of us still in lockdown?
No, I just made them up to be stupid because it was like I think we were in lockdown at the time and people were singing, you know, songs, clips of them singing, and I had friends that were singing most every day, and I'm going, "I can't sing." So I thought, okay, I'll tell a few jokes. I just made them up on the spot. It's stupid.
I love them. I think we'll just direct our listeners to your Instagram to check them out for themselves.
Yeah, yeah.
For a more serious question, so you have starred in blockbusters such as Mad Max and The Great Gatsby, to just name a couple.
Yeah.
As a contrast to these films, what do you like most about working on Australian short films?
Yeah, so the thing about short films is there's still a hell of a lot of filmmaking in a short film. I mean, there is. I think people think, it's a short film, therefore it must have been cheap and quick and easy. You know, there's as much detail in a short film as there is in a feature. I mean, there are features. They're just shorter versions, of the genre, but they're as complex, and it's like Jenny's film. They're as demanding on actors to, you know, because my job in anything I do, whether it's theatre or film or television, is to serve the writer. That's my job. And to serve the director too, their interpretation, but at the root of it is to serve the writer's intention. So, and that can be a psychological workout to try and get there. So there is as much involved in that in short films as there is in feature length films. It's still, you've got to lift this character off the page and serve someone else's vision. So I love Australian film. I love Australian everything. And I think we are so rich in talent, you know, in our crews too, not only performers, but our crews and producers and directors. And because we're very used to in this country about all pitching in for something. And, you know, you go to work on an Australian film set and sort of everyone, you can feel the collective energy of everybody driving this project forward. Where I think I worked in the UK on a series for the BBC for 2 years, and it was very much, you know, you couldn't touch, you know, the sound department couldn't touch that sandbag because it was part of the electrics department.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh my gosh.
And that, you know, you couldn't. That was your area and you worked only in that area. You couldn't cross over and help somebody, you know, and it was like, what? So I think we're blessed here by this attitude of pitching in and making it happen.
Hmm.
And that was great to work with a lot of the students from AFTERS too on The Stranger because, you know, they're newcomers and they're learning and they're, you know, and it was great. It was such great energy on the set.
Mm.
It was terrific.
Oh, fantastic. That's so great to hear. Yeah. Steve, thank you so much for joining us on the show today.
It's my pleasure, Ellen, and be safe over there.
Oh, we will. We'll read some more jokes.
Yeah, a horse walks into a bar and the barber says, why the long face? You know.
Awesome. Thank you, Steve.
Awesome, did you say?
Oh! You got me there.
Thanks, Ellen.
All right, yeah, amazing.
Thanks, Ellen.
Ellen was just speaking to Steve Bisley about The Stranger, a short film that is showing as part of the Sydney Film Festival this November. You can grab your tickets at sff.org.au. You're listening to 2SER.
Would you like Carliola singing on your next single? Due to the COVID-19 lockdown, we've extended our deadline for our Carliola song competition. So if you have a great boogie, soul, funk or disco sounding track, head over to 2ser.com/CarliComp to enter and you could have your next song pressed to vinyl with Carly as the vocalist. Brought to you by 2SER, Grooscooter and APRA AMCOS.
You're listening to Carve Arts and Culture on 2SER. And did you know that the Melbourne International Film Festival is currently on? Line? That's right. The cinema viewings this year have been replaced entirely by an online streaming service, which can be found at the MIFF or M-I-F-F website. Head to miff.com.au to browse a huge selection of this year's films. One of those films is Dry Winter, the directorial debut of Kyle Davis, which has been described as a hypnotic portrait of a young couple surviving life in an off-the-beaten-track, opportunity-starved outback town. I'm pleased to be joined by the film's director, Kyle Davis, now. Kyle Davis, thank you so much for joining me on Carve today.
Pleasure to be here, thanks.
So obviously we've got you on the show to talk about your film Dry Winter, which is part of this year's Melbourne International Film Festival, which is obviously being streamed this year due to obvious reasons that we probably don't have to get into. The first thing I just wanted to ask, Dry Winter, what is this film about and what compelled you to make it?
So it's a story of a couple in a sort of really remote part of South Australia. It's kind of between the ocean and the desert, sort of stuck in the middle of nowhere. And it's just, it's very, you know, dialed into their kind of day to day and all the things that can kind of wear you down over time. And, you know, there's happiness in there as well, but yeah, it's kind of just this real like deep dive focus on this kind of lifestyle that, you know, it's pretty unique, I guess.
Yeah.
To make it, yeah. Sorry.
No, no, you go on.
Oh, no, to make it, it was just kind of, you know, as it started with like an idea of, yeah, just isolation, just focusing on these people. Mm. And then it kind of, it had to become practical and, you know, it kind of follows those lines where you end up just making something different from what you originally planned, but still just as interesting.
Yeah. You mentioned isolation. Obviously it's a word that everyone's hearing more and more lately.
Yeah, unfortunately.
You know, whether you're living, you know, in regional Australia or not, was the current state of the world at all a reason for why you felt like this was a good time to make it, or was it just
no, because the film was shot in 2018, so it had a long post-production.
There you go.
But yeah, it was before anyone was talking about, you know, we didn't know anything about that obviously. So I don't know, maybe it's a little bit unfortunate that it crosses over and you get that mention of isolation and you're talking about two things, but I don't know, whatever people relate to, I guess.
Absolutely. Also with this film, I think it's one that I get the sense that you couldn't have made it without having some sort of direct experience with regional Australia and this sort of, you know, this lifestyle. What's your relation to the film directly?
So we all grew up different kind of areas in that. Like I'm from South Africa. I'm not from regional Australia or anything, but obviously like lots of family have lived in these areas and that. And Gear, the cinematographer, his family friend she was one of the kind of production managers on the film. So he spent a lot of time going to Cal as a kid. Mm. And then he sort of said, you know, like we could probably film in this place because we'd have a support network. We'd have these kind of, you know, people that could help us out a little bit. So they were kind of, her name's Liz. She was kind of a link to everything. Like she set up a lot of stuff for us and introduced us to a lot of people. So that was pretty good.
Yeah, cool. The decision to cast non-actors in the film, was that a purposeful choice thematically, or did you just happen to have a couple of people that you thought would be great in the roles who weren't necessarily?
No, I think it's the same thing when you're not really from a place. Like if we had brought in actors and then had to, you know, do this, you'd seem a bit strange to be going like and coming away with these conclusions and then coming to the actors and saying, you know, you're going to be doing this. And they're not from there, you know, this is how you're going to be a country kid or whatever, you know, just be a bit strange. So it seemed kind of like counterintuitive, like may as well cast people. And it's more interesting anyway to cast people from the area. So
yeah. Was it a challenge at all to get non-actors to agree to do this film with you? Cause I can imagine it would be quite daunting.
Yeah. It's hard because I think when we put out like a casting call, you get a lot of people who want to be actors. And then they're not necessarily the people that you want in that film. You know, you're looking for people that are a bit different to that, as much as like actors are great, but you know, we're looking for different people. So a lot of people coming in drama programs or had done a bit of singing, but they'd all moved away and doing things elsewhere. So it was pretty hard to get people that, you know, were both interested in doing it and felt like they were right for the movie. So it took quite a long time.
Yeah, cool. There is a distinct use of silence in this film, which to me feels very Australian and very kind of outback, and it feels, my take on watching it was very much, I got that sense of being worn down by the landscape and the very Australian thing of not feeling the need to fill every moment with words. Even the trailer is just music really, and then just like landscape shots. Was this the intended effect, I suppose?
I think so, yeah. Like you said, it's just a byproduct of where you film as well. You know, it's kind of going to happen when you film in the outback. You know, things aren't going to be loud all the time and people aren't going to be talking. And, you know, we tried to stay pretty realistic with that, which may not be how a normal movie should work with dialogue and things like that. But a lot of the time, you know, people do kind of cruise around in silence or whatever. So,
Who is this film for, if you had to name? You know, yeah. If you had to,
who's it for? What, an audience or something?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know. Like, is it? Yeah. Who's it for? Is it for people from the city to get an idea of what's going on in regional Australia, or is it for, you know, people from those areas?
Anyone who kind of, I suppose, just anyone who has an interest. Like, you know, we don't want it to be like a like ethnographic thing, you know, where people are like, you know, fascinated, I suppose, like just like, oh, how do they do it here? How do they do it there? But it's just a simple kind of story, you know, of a couple being worn down. So anyone, I think, can, you know, relate to different things in it. Like people have, you know, said they might not have grown up in a country town, but they know the feeling, or, you know, the suburbs have the same kind of alienation sometimes. So I think anyone could get into it, just as long as they're willing to embrace the style.
Yeah. You mentioned that you guys filmed this in 2018, which I hadn't realized before doing this interview. So 3 years on to now be kind of promoting it and talking about it, have the reasons behind why you made it evolved or changed at all, or what's different now than back then?
I suppose, your ideas about movies change, and, you know, you think, not that you wanted to do stuff different, but you think it's more just thinking about what to do next, you know, what interests me going forward. And there's maybe like ideas that we won't follow, but there's ideas that, you know, came out really strong that you will use in the next thing. So I don't know, it's kind of, because we didn't talk about it so long, it doesn't feel bad to talk about it in any way. You know, it's kind of new to us because it sat for so long before all the sound was fixed and everything. So yeah, it's kind of, it still feels somewhat new to us.
Speaking of moving forward with you, your career, and filmmaking in general, this was your directorial debut, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
I have any further ambitions ignited in you during this project or since? I mean, you know, obviously it's been a while since filming it.
Yeah, yeah. I think we've always been working on other stuff. It's just getting it to take off, and I think half of it, you know, you kind of just have to start taking those steps and hope everything else follows. But I think we're getting to the point now where we're ready to make the next thing, hopefully another feature and somewhat, you know, same methodology at least, you know, because that really worked for us and working in that way.
Yeah.
But obviously, yeah, different ideas about story and, all that's kind of changed a bit, I think, so in a good way.
Yep. Do you think you would, moving forward, go with, do you think you're sworn off casting actors forever? Or do you think, is that your style?
I mean, it's as long as, I mean, whoever's obviously good for it. I think if you knew good actors or you knew where you could get good actors, that's not a problem. But it's just, I think when you're starting out and you're doing things for very little money, like obviously you're paying people, but it's still, you know, I don't want to badmouth any actors or any, I just don't know, you know, like at the amateur level, when you're both there, you're kind of looking for what makes the movie the best. And sometimes, you know, actors from the exact same places, you've had the exact same experience, you doesn't quite cut it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, even the Academy Award winning film this year, Nomadland, had a huge chunk of their cast that were non-actors.
Yeah.
So it proved the authenticity, it works.
Yeah. I think, you can do different things with it as well, I suppose. Like, obviously now the big things, everyone talks about authenticity and that, but I suppose people have been using them for a long time in different ways. So.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, Kyle, thank you so much for joining me today on Carve, and all the best for the season. Obviously, Dry Winter plays or is available to stream until August 22. So from the time of airing, is about a week left. If you'd like to go check it out, go to play.miff.com.au/film/dry-winter. Kyle, thanks so much and all the best.
Great. Thank you very much.
Cheers. I was just speaking with Kyle Davis, the director of Dry Winter, a film in this year's Melbourne International Film Festival, which is available for streaming until August 22. You're listening to 2SER.
I'm Professor Rob Brooks, and I'm interested in you. In fact, I'm interested in all people, because I'm an evolutionary biologist. What's that mean? Well, put simply, I study how sex has shaped human lives and societies. Things like how we choose mates, the clever ways we make ourselves attractive, and how sex is linked to diet and lifespan. Interesting, hey? It's all science. This National Science Week, find an event near you or online at scienceweek.net.au.
That's the show for another week. Thank you so much for carving out your time with us on a Saturday to get your fix of Sydney arts and culture, especially during lockdown. As always, we'll put links to everything we covered on today's show on our website at 2ser.com/carve-arts. Now to take us out, here's a new single released from another friend of the show, Fergus Bailey and the Teeth, his Dancing Song.
is a hold of me. With my head full of fear, she suddenly appeared. Sibilant and blurred, she spoke these words. Atop the curve, observe a bird. It's brave, but it's there. And sing, the valley rings. I've no voice to share. To share. So I dance. Oh, I dance. And so I dance. Oh, yeah, I dance.
Gives us reason to give life. about his feelings while he's feeling numb. We live in a vacuum.